You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. This week in Washington, D.C., the NATO summit is taking place, grinding traffic to a halt and fueling the discussion of what will happen during the next presidential term. Today, in the last 3 years since Ukraine was invaded, a record 23 NATO allies are at or above the minimum 2% of GDP, which is required in terms of their defense spending. You have to spend 2% of your GDP on defense under NATO rules. That's actually more than twice as many as in 2021. But it's also informed by the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine. It's also, according to the White House, 8 times higher than when the allies first set the 2% benchmark about a decade ago. Republicans right now are bemoaning the fact that the U.S. continues to be the largest contributor. And let's put some gloss on that, because everybody, both sides of the election, are pointing out this fact, which is that the United States is the single largest contributor to NATO operations, spending a whopping $860 billion, or 68% of total NATO spending, which is roughly 3.5 of our gross national product on defense. That is an important fact, but we are rolling into an election, and Trump's closest advisors are now saying that the remaining countries that don't contribute the 2% would not enjoy the security guarantees articulated in NATO. Principally, one of them is the Article 5, which is the, if any of us is attacked, we will all defend that nation. So be on the lookout this week, but we've called previously two experts to this podcast, and we thought it was a really good time to go back over some of their important facts and words. They're both real students of NATO. We also wish to commend to you a book called Not One More Inch, which is by Mary Surratt. I'm not sure how she pronounces it, but we'll hyperlink that in the notes. It gives a very detailed history, including White House notes and exchanges between major world leaders going back to the beginning of NATO. And it also explains what happened in terms of the movement of NATO eastward in Europe during Clinton's administration, which apparently became a source of real rage for Putin. As you know, he continues to bring it up every chance he gets at every security conference, and has been doing so for the last almost 20 years now. But it's a good education if you're trying to understand this. But we'll also help you understand probably a lot of the conversation that will emerge from the NATO summit this week. We have two different candidates right now with very different visions for what NATO will look like and how the United States will participate. So right now we're going to replay portions of our recording with Erwin Logodek as well as Simon Miles. Their bios are contained in the portions of the podcast that we play. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy this information on NATO and it makes you a better lawyer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're looking at NATO form and reform before our eyes during this conflict, but take us back, please, and give us a bit of history. How and why did NATO start? And also paint a picture for us of the situation in Europe in 1949 as NATO was forming.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's useful to look back at the early days of NATO, not for the sake of a historical excursion, but because part of what the where the conflict is waged right now between Russia and the West is also in terms of narratives of what NATO's history has been about. If we backtrack to 1949, what you're looking at is initially an effort between the French and the British in 1947 to create yet another bilateral alliance between the two of them, because they are concerned about yet another phase of German rearmament. But that's 47. Quickly enough, in 48, 49, you're seeing the end of the alliance between the British, the Americans, the French on one side, and the Soviet Union on the other. It's increasingly clear by 1948. that the USSR is what you need to be worried about. So in 1948, a number of European, Western European nations come together and sign on to the so-called Brussels Treaty, which is also meant to indicate to the United States that Western Europeans might be taking their security seriously and bonding together primarily to take on the Soviet threats, but that they need the US to come in, to come back in, because make no mistake, the US had mostly left Europe after 1945. So there is no continuity between 45 and the creation of NATO in 49. The Europeans needed to ask the Truman administration and the US Senate to come back in. And they do so by way of that initial Brussels Treaty in 1948, which then entices the US Senate to accept the need for the US to sign on to what, if you think back to the Washington farewell address in 1796, if memory serves, Washington had warned the US against a permanent alliance, permanent entanglement with Europe. And that's precisely the taboo that is broken in April 1949 with the creation of NATO, where the US accepts to reinvest itself in Western European security by providing, especially through Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, a collective defense commitment to Western Europe. The twist to the story is that the US eventually was enticed into that alliance by way of a quid pro quo, where the language of the collective security, Article 5 in NATO's founding treaty, was somewhat watered down, so that to this day, Article 5 does not say that if any ally is attacked, you need to go to war on their behalf, because that would be preempting the US Senate's right to declare war. The Article 5 only says that should one of the allies be attacked through a military aggression, then all allies need to essentially think about what they are going to do in response, but without spelling out what that should be. Final point that I would make, that even though by April 1949, it is now clear that the enemy de facto is going to be the Soviet Union, and that's the primary security threat. A couple of caveats here. Number one is that the NATO treaty does not spell out that the enemy is the Soviet Union. There was great wisdom in the ability of NATO to navigate the post-Cold War era, because after 1991, a strong argument to keep NATO alive was that it had never claimed that the problem was the Soviet Union, even though that was self-evident in the early days. The second point that I would make is that let's recall that NATO is also a European alliance. That's a point that many sort of anti-American observers and policymakers in the likes of France occasionally have lost sight of, is that NATO is not only about enshrining a US security guarantee in Europe, but is also initially a European alliance that managed to add the US's signature on what had been initially a European treaty.
Let's talk about the First Nations, though, that were in it. It is indeed a European alliance, and we're seeing it expand before our eyes. But at the very beginning, who were the beginners of it, other than the United States?
Well, I wish we were seeing it expand before our eyes, but Erdogan and Orban, to some extent, seem to have different ideas about the pace of this. Anyways, yes, to your question, the general idea is that the allies in Western Europe and North America were going to defend themselves against the Soviet threat, essentially cut and pasting the strategic template that they had used against Nazi Germany, which is you need to prevent the Soviet Union from breaking out through the Baltic Sea and the Black Sea. You need to lock in the Soviet Union, and that is why you need a North Atlantic alliance. The United States at the same time is concerned that if the UK and the French especially are going to be members of that alliance, they are concerned that they're going to be dragged into colonial wars on behalf of the French and the British. And so there is, the founding treaty does specify that only a security issue in the North Atlantic and in Europe would warrant invoking Article 5. But other than that caveat, yeah, the template is North America is going to be the arsenal of democracy, is going to set itself up to come in if needed and support and reinforce Western European defense effort against a Soviet incursion, potentially with a last readout in the likes of the UK and the Iberian Peninsula if the Soviets do break through initially. So long story short, you have 12 founding members the likes of the so-called Benelux countries, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, the French, the Italians. Interestingly, the Portuguese were among the founding members, which has been a bit of an issue for NATO to then explain that it's been an alliance of values from the start, because if you recall, until the 1970s, Portugal is an authoritarian and quasi-fascist regime, and yet it was one of the founding members. Now, why that was is because for something as cynical as the fact that the alliance needed the Azores archipelago in the mid-Atlantic to be able to easily refuel aircraft on their way from North America to Europe at a time where their range was not enough to do it easily in cross the Atlantic easily in one go. So interesting that Portugal should have been part of the alliance. Interesting as well that Iceland is part of the alliance when it does not have a standing military, but you need Iceland in order to complete the so-called GI-UK gap from Greenland to Iceland to the UK. If you hold that line, the Soviets, as before them, the Nazis and the First Reich, cannot break through and mess with your resupply naval lanes of passage in the North Atlantic.
So we were willing to overlook a lack of a standing military and an authoritarian leader for practical purposes in order to make this alliance effective. So let's talk about this history. We've talked a bit about the rule regarding invoking Article 5. But let's talk about how many times that has actually happened since the creation of NATO.
The easy answer, it has happened only once, but then not really. What's fascinating is that Article 5 was designed so that the US could supply security to Europe in case Europe came under an armed attack on the part, presumably, of the Soviet Union. And that never happened, thankfully. In fact, NATO never fired a shot in anger throughout the Cold War. The first time that NATO shot at anybody, a NATO-affiliated military shot at anybody, was in the early 1990s during the Bosnia War. The only time that NATO did invoke Article 5 was, oddly enough, in the wake of 9/11, right? On September 12th, at the initiative of the Europeans primarily, and the Secretary General at the time, Lord Robertson, the European allies come together and decide that what just happened in Virginia and New York City is most likely serious enough of an aggression to warrant invoking Article 5. They do have a number of footnotes there. In the early days, they are not entirely sure that the attack came from abroad and is not about domestic terrorism. So they say that the Europeans say that they need to wait until the responsibilities are established, but eventually they were. And so NATO, essentially the European allies, offered their help to the Americans in response to 9/11. So when Article 5 had been designed so that the US could support European security, the only time it ever was invoked was the vice versa, the mirror image of that paradigm. What's also intriguing, and that's what I said in jest, that it had been invoked, but not really, is that the Americans, by and large, had no interest in accepting NATO's help. If you recall, you're talking about the first George W. Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld at the DOD, and they were very much intent on designing their response, especially in Afghanistan, as they pleased and based on Rumsfeld's belief in coalitions of the willing, if you recall.
Right. Yes, the willing. The mission. Some of whom gave only flashlights, right? That was their contribution.
Yeah, the mission determines the coalition and not vice versa. So the Americans essentially saying thanks, but no thanks. There were a number of missions that came about due to the invocation of Article 5 after 9/11, but fairly minor, such as securing the Eastern Mediterranean and deploying NATO AWACS aircraft to help secure the US's airspace. But what is surprising, I would think, for most casual observers of NATO is that NATO's intervention in Afghanistan was not a product of the invocation of Article 5, even though it sounds like it. Indeed, NATO only really started acting as NATO in Afghanistan in 2003, 2 years after the start of the Enduring Freedom mission. So, long story short, the irony of all of this is that Article 5 was designed so that the US would come to Europe's help in case of an armed attack by a state, a great power like the Soviet Union, and Article 5 would precipitate a massive collective conventional defense effort, potentially nuclear response as well. And in the fact of the matter is the one time that Article 5 has been invoked was in response to terrorism, not the Soviet, was a European response to help the US, not vice versa, and indeed did not lead to much of anything.
No, not much of anything, although arguably those wars did seem to create more terrorists on some level, maybe, and other problems. But let's go back for a minute. You mentioned, so the 1991 was the time of the Bosnian War, but prior to that, the wall came down in Berlin and there was no Soviet Union left really at that point in time. Although it does appear currently that Putin, as an issue of legacy for himself, appears to want to resurrect that perhaps even more grandly than it may have existed during his youth and service in East Germany. But if you could also educate us, there was a period of time, particularly during the Clinton administration, when NATO suddenly expanded and ballooned. Talk a little bit about that. What happened and how was that received by these remnants, these fragments and artifacts of the Soviet Union?
Yeah, it's a couple of things. First, we need to be careful with the words that we use. And I would say that NATO is very keen on making the point that it has enlarged, not expanded, because I suppose expansion makes it sound like there is a secret headquarters in NATO where the US and NATO authorities carefully plan which country they are going to swallow up next in order to, for instance, encircle and humiliate Russia. And that seems to be Putin's take on what's been happening since the end of the Cold War. Enlargement, on the other hand, I would argue, provides a better reflection of what really happened is that a number of Central and Eastern European countries, based on a sovereign and democratic decision, and in fact, based on the fact that they remain concerned by the Russian security threat to themselves, those nations, instead of a pull factor, it was a push factor that they decided to apply to join NATO for very sound reasons, and that NATO then had to decide whether or not to accept those applications and occasionally drew a line, like in 2008, when the process to try and take one more step in a rapprochement between NATO and Ukraine was vetoed by French President Sarkozy and German Chancellor Merkel. So there was no automaticity, no self-evidence in the process of NATO enlargement, and it was not sort of out of central planning, so to speak. It happened because of the very valid security concerns of countries that decided to apply. Now, you're right that initially there was certainly a dilemma and this hesitation among the Clinton administration whether or not it was wise not only to keep NATO alive versus going back to trying again from scratch to create a new security architecture in Europe that would potentially include the Soviet Union and later on the Russian Federation. Someone as esteemed as George Kennan, for instance, was adamant that his theory of containment that he'd propounded in 47, 48 was now no longer applicable and that enlarging NATO would now be a mistake. Yeah, hesitation for a couple of years and then eventually, including for interesting domestic political reasons, that there is still to this day a Central European constituency in the United States with votes that can be tremendously helpful in the likes of New York State, Pennsylvania, Chicago, and the upper Midwest and whatnot. And so the decision was made to at least open the door to the likes of Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary as a first round of enlargement. I would point out as well that as many of your listeners might be aware, there's an old debate that's been pushed among the Putin talking points about whether NATO and especially the US administration ever promised the Soviet Union and later on Russia that it would not enlarge to the east. And we need to, you know, call time on that discussion, which is largely a waste of time for a couple of reasons. And if you listen to Gorbachev himself, he used to say that there never was a promise made to him that NATO would not enlarge. Now, the caveat to that is, of course, he would say so to not end up with egg on his face that he was lied to. We've had some documents declassified, including by my university at George Washington, in the past few years. The end result is a fairly messy one, that it looks like people like James Baker, German, French leadership in the complex rounds of negotiations in about the reunification of Germany, did promise the Soviet leadership, meaning Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, that they would not expand to the east, enlarge to the east, I should say. And the debate is whether they meant that NATO would not enlarge to East Germany as it existed then, or whether somehow those Western negotiators could read the tea leaves and saw the sole value in already committing to the Soviets that should the Warsaw Pact collapse, which it had not in 1990, then NATO would not enlarge to include former Warsaw Pact members. It's a bit tricky to think like that someone like Jim Baker could have seen the upcoming collapse of the Warsaw Pact and would have seen value in committing to Gorbachev that the likes of Poland and Hungary would never become NATO members. But regardless of one's opinion on the matter, the truth is ultimately that any promise, any discussion, any arguments were made vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, which only collapsed in late 1991, of course, and that everything changed with the collapse of the Soviet Union, which, of course, Jim Baker could not have seen coming. And so Putin, when he claims that NATO promised not to ever enlarge to Eastern Europe, is over hasty in equating the Soviet Union with Russia. The moment when the Soviet Union collapses, everything changes, and whatever promises had been made to Gorbachev are obviously moot.
And he did bring this up. He brought it up quite famously during the Munich Security Conference of 2007 and ranted. I think by American standards, it was a curious rant, referencing ancient grievances, you know, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, promises he claimed have been made, and the words were expansion, I believe, as translated. He did falsely claim about promises regarding expansion. Of course, to your point, I don't know that anyone could have seen in that moment a man quite like Putin staking his legacy on such a terrible act either. And I think any nation should feel free to revisit any promises made in the face of such a global security threat. But I'd like to pivot to something that we also heard a lot about. It got a lot of press, which was the relationship between NATO member states and Donald Trump during his presidency. He famously threatened to withdraw the United States from NATO if the member states did not pay their fair share. So let's talk for a minute. It wasn't just his complaint. Other leaders had raised this issue before, and they had done so perhaps more quietly. What was he complaining about, and how did the member nations respond to these threats?
Yeah, there was a basic misunderstanding on his part, or at least he pretended that there was, so he would have a cleaner political argument to sell domestically, which is he framed the issue of burden sharing and free riding within NATO as though NATO had a central budget and that allies were expected to pay a vast amount of money, so 2% of their GDP into that collective budget, and that they were delinquent as someone renting a flat in a Trump Tower building was delinquent on their rent. So that's not how it works, right? What we're talking about here in terms of burden sharing is that there is a soft guideline within NATO, certainly not a legal one, that each ally should spend 2% of their GDP on their own defense, right? Spend 2% of their GDP should go towards their defense ministry and primarily, or at least in part, 20% of that amount should go to what's useful in terms of investment, which is procurement and R&D. So, yeah, number one, it's a soft guideline. Number two, it's about how much you pay for your own defense, and it's not about how much you pay into NATO's pockets, because the cost of NATO itself as an organization is minute. It's a few hundred million dollars a year. So that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about writing a check to NATO, but making sure that the European allies can spend what they said they should in order for them to effectively contribute to collective defense within NATO and not entirely rely, or not primarily rely, on the US's security guarantee. So I suppose that was Trump's main complaint about NATO. The second one that he mentioned was when he said, especially during his campaign, that NATO had become obsolete, is that he at the time did not see the value of a collective alliance that would secure Europe and North America against external security threats, conventional security threats, including on the part of Russia. And he wanted an update in NATO's agenda such that NATO would do more on counterterrorism, including so NATO, in Trump's view, would pull its weight in the likes of Afghanistan and the Middle East, including Iraq, because Trump was sick and tired of with the idea that the US was taking on an unfair burden in tackling international terrorism. And so you're right that a number of NATO allies were delighted, in fact, by that push on the Trump administration's part, at least the substance of it. And someone like NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg, in fact, managed to massage Trump's language and in ways that Trump, he ended up being the ultimate Trump whisperer, right? Making the most out of the lemons that the Trump administration threw him by leveraging that pressure, playing good cop, bad cop with Trump's Twitter account. So that he did manage to collectively that pressure, and that's the ambiguity, the simultaneous pressure brought about by the start of the Ukraine crisis in early 2014. You end up with a summit in Wales in the UK, September 2014, when the allies agree to recommit to spending 2% of their GDP on defense, or at least attempting to, by 2024. Back then, before 2014, you're looking at about three allies that met that threshold of 2%. Stoltenberg is very keen to tell you that nowadays eight allies, five more, have reached the threshold since 2014, and that the end result, the grand total of the additional spending on defense among all allies, is something like, if I recall, 300 billion total. So essentially NATO would have added something like six times the French military budget, the equivalent of that in the year since 2014 because of this additional spending.
Let's talk a little bit. The rumors were flying at the beginning of this most recent push into Ukraine by Putin. And one of the things that was covered quite a bit by the American, British, Canadian press, Le Monde English, was a suggestion that NATO didn't look so great in reality in terms of its functionality, any budget it might have, military preparedness, and its status. But how did that, and referring here, of course, even to its hardware, how did that change with the invasion of Ukraine, both the perception and any reality, if it did?
Right. Well, I think that what we mostly need to be concerned about is still to this day political will to make the most out of the military resources that do exist, because there are shortcomings. But when you look, for instance, at the German debate on whether or not to supply Leopard tanks to Ukraine, and we might have some news as early as tomorrow, Wednesday, but clearly we are not yet at the point where the problem is that Western European stocks are empty. We are still looking at the picture where what the issue is whether the Allies are willing to supply weapons to Ukraine. But I think there's another question involved in what you're asking, is also whether NATO has proved itself to be capable and to have an adequate posture in case Russia should try anything against NATO itself. What's for sure is the Russian threat to NATO has been heavily diminished by the travails of the Russian military in Ukraine. They've had to deplete to a large extent their Western military region to keep the war effort in Ukraine going. So that's the cynical silver lining to what we've seen is, if anything, I think that the Baltic states, for instance, would rest easier now that they've both, because they've seen how disastrous Russian military performance has been, but also because, to be blunt, Putin is now incapable of trying anything serious, at least from a conventional standpoint, against the likes of the Baltics and Poland, if he ever dreamed of doing so. But that being said, yes, the easy answer to your question is that, yes, NATO has had a bit of a come-to-Jesus moment in terms of accepting some of its gaps in terms of military capacities. There has been so much that's been learned over the past, 11 months by now, in terms of the likelihood of great power conflict in Europe. Here, I suppose I would single out the French and the Germans. The Germans, of course, have had a very steep learning curve about the resurgence of great power conflict in Europe, and they've had to take a very hard look at the parlous state of their military, and that's why the unhappy German defense minister, Christine Lambrecht, was summarily dismissed not too long ago, and good luck to her successor. But the key is whether they are going to effect the so-called Zeitenwende, the change of eras that Chancellor Scholz had promised, where he essentially promised that he would drag Germany kicking and screaming from so many of its foreign policy paradigms in terms of the use of force in Europe. And that's what's being decided right now in terms of the wisdom of supplying German main battle tanks to Ukraine. Meanwhile, in France, there's also been some degree of concern about what the Ukraine war has highlighted in terms of potential lack of supplies and deficiencies in the French military industrial base. And you saw the reaction last week on the part of Macron that he's going to invest, if memory serves, 60 billion a year in French defense. Essentially something like one third to one half more of the existing military budget in France over the next 7 years. So really a step change in how seriously France is going to take its conventional defense going forward.
And now we'll transition to Simon Miles on the history of the Warsaw Pact and how the NATO alliance has transformed over the last six decades.
We're here today to talk about NATO, what it means to Putin, what it meant when the wall came down so many years ago. Is it what we think, or is it considerably more complex? History tells us a lot. And so today we're speaking with Simon Miles. He is the author of Engaging with the Evil Empire, Washington, Moscow, and the Beginning of the End of the Cold War. Simon is also an assistant professor of Slavic and Eurasian studies at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Have I hit it right?
Yes.
Great. Hey, Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to it. NATO had the Warsaw Pact. How did these two alliances develop in the first place? Teach us a little history here.
Yeah, the proverbial sharks and the jets of the Cold War. So the origins of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Warsaw Pact both are rooted in kind of the uncertainty of what was going to happen at the end of World War II. It came to be that Europe started to look quite divided as Joseph Stalin, the leader of the Soviet Union, insisted on basically a sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, which rapidly became a sphere of domination in Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, in Western Europe, countries like Britain, France, the Benelux countries, all tried to rebuild in the aftermath of the devastations of the Second World War. So let's talk about NATO first. In order to understand NATO, we need to understand another American policy initiative, which actually stemmed from Washington, and that's the Marshall Plan. So it's probably no surprise to your listeners that World War II extracted a horrible toll on the nations of Western Europe and, of course, Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Bombing, strategic bombing, pitched battles in urban centers in many cases left a whole lot that needed to be rebuilt. And so the Marshall Plan was the Truman administration, President Harry Truman's, effort to help kickstart European reconstruction, named after the Secretary of State, George C. Marshall, at the time. The Marshall Plan was a lot of money, but the Marshall Plan didn't address one key question, which was what we would probably today call investor confidence. If you had built a brand new factory in 1919 after World War I, your return on investment was, odds are, not great, because about two decades later, it was flattened again. The point of NATO was to show to the Europeans, not only are we going to help reconstruct you, but we're going to stand by you. And by standing by you, we are going to diminish the likelihood of yet another cataclysmic total war on the European continent. So NATO is actually a European initiative to which the United States acquiesces. And I think that's the first really important point that we need to acknowledge here, is that NATO is built up by the Europeans. It's not imposed by the Americans. Fast forward now about a half a decade to the mid-1950s, NATO is really coming into its own. In the wake, for example, of the Korean War, which really escalated the perception of threat, countries started to ask what were at the time really politically difficult questions. Like, for example, what do we do about Germany? In the immediate aftermath of World War II, the decision is made to partition the country. But then the two halves of Germany, which we'll just call West and East Germany, are administered in very different ways. The Kremlin sees its role in Germany as above all extraction, that is to say, extracting reparations for the Second World War, and of course, imposes a communist regime under the leadership of a man named Walter Ulbricht. The Americans, the British, and the French initially also start thinking along, let's say, punitive lines. But over the years, they realize that the logic behind punishing Germany was that a powerful Germany would be too powerful really to contain, and had twice in very recent memory started cataclysmic wars. Then the calculus starts to shift when the world starts to look a lot more dangerous. When Joseph Stalin isn't just hard to deal with, he's a threat. And then the conversation starts to be, we should rearm Germany, which is politically huge. If you tell the people of France, or frankly, the people of Poland, that Germany is going to be rearmed, this doesn't sound like good news. This doesn't sound like a recipe for safety. In response to that, the Eastern European states with the Soviet Union form what comes to be called the Warsaw Pact as a sort of retaliation for the policy of rearming and integrating into NATO of West Germany.
Okay, well, that's considerably more nuanced than you will see in the U.S. press. And I'd query which you see as the sharks and which you see as the jets in this situation. Because remember, when you're a jet all the way from your Tourette to your last dying day.
Well, I think that means the NATO are the jets, right? Because they stay. And the Warsaw Pact members, after the Warsaw Pact collapses in 1991, all want to join NATO. But I think we're going to talk more about that a little later.
Let's go to the time when things start to change and they shift dramatically, which is the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was heralded in the United States and I think in a lot of countries as a real triumphant moment for democratic values. But let's be realistic here. What was the impact on former Warsaw Pact countries? And frankly, what was the impact on what happened subsequently in Russia in terms of their perception of these alliances and NATO in particular?
Well, first and foremost, the story of kind of Eastern Europe's integration with the West begins a decade plus before the actual Berlin Wall falls down. In actual fact, the Berlin Wall was much more porous in terms of governments and policies than is often acknowledged. It certainly was a very rigid barrier for people. And to the best extent that the Eastern Bloc could make it so, a rigid barrier for ideas. You know, Radio Free Europe was jammed and things like that. Not always successfully, of course. So by the time the late 1980s are coming around, in fact, it's a pretty common understanding in Eastern European capitals that change is coming. They don't know it's going to be as sharp and as revolutionary as when the Berlin Wall falls on the night of the 9th of November, 1989. But governments in places like, for example, Hungary are starting to open up the borders with neighboring Austria. Hungary also is starting to allow more and more market activity in its economy. Countries like Poland are opening up the political system and allowing non-communists, in this case, the Solidarity Trade Union, to participate in what at the time are called round tables, but we would think of as kind of basically participating in government. And then the Berlin Wall comes down. So it's not necessarily just this black and white kind of transformation, though it is, of course, revolutionary. When the wall comes down, and most importantly, when the Soviet Union does nothing about that, doesn't try to stop it, doesn't try to do what they did in Czechoslovakia in 1968, doesn't try to do what they had done in Hungary in 1956, then even communist politicians recognize that the time has come to try to cast their lot in with the West. So viewed from as diverse a range of places as East Berlin to Bucharest, Romania, the sense of the time, this is the very late 1980s, very early 1990s, is that the future belongs to, let's say, Western-style institutions. Now, we always talk about this in the context of NATO, right? NATO expansion, all that. They're not talking about NATO in Eastern Europe in 1989, 1990, and 1991. They're talking about, at the time, the European Economic Community, what we now know as the European Union, because they see the key to their own success and prosperity in the future as European political, social, and cultural, and of course, above all, economic integration by participating in the free trade and sort of commonwealth of Europe. So why NATO? Well, they're actually basically told NATO is your stepping stone. Let's not forget that in the early 1990s, the European Union is still a fledgling entity, right? 1993's Maastricht Treaty hasn't yet gone into effect. And so Eastern Bloc politicians are kind of going to Brussels and saying, hey, we'd really love to join the EU. The EU folks are saying, well, you know, we kind of are just getting this thing off the ground. And frankly, negotiating the Maastricht Treaty was a nightmare. The last thing we want to do is reopen that in order to add more people. So why don't you just go kind of down the road to NATO, sign on there, and then we will take, you know, further steps in the future once you've kind of proven your bona fides.
So NATO was the country club where you could meet the people who would help you start the business.
And EU was the big deal, which isn't to say that they weren't happy for NATO membership or interested in an American kind of Article 5 security guarantee. But the North Star that's sort of driving policy in Eastern European countries at this time, even amongst avowedly communist leaders, is the European Union.
Yeah, well, without trade, they weren't doing so well financially, and that makes perfect sense.
And they needed access to technology. That was another big part of it, is their economies were backwards and grossly inefficient. They needed access on a large, large scale to Western technology, as opposed to kind of one-off licensing deals and joint ventures, which they'd been doing in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. And Russia wasn't particularly known for their technology and wasn't able to supply that. Although I will say, I see a lot of those old Ladas driving around Africa and they seem to be just fine. Okay, well, let's go to the 1990s. I don't know that a lot of the young lawyers, a lot of the sort of young policymakers really realize what happened in the 1990s in terms of NATO expansion. Can you talk about how NATO expanded during the 90s? Who exactly or what administration was driving that expansion? And what did that do to the psyche of people who had lived for 40 years under the pact or sort of under the general understanding, the social contract that really was created in Moscow?
Well, I think the story of NATO expansion is often told as kind of the story of Bill Clinton's hubris. You know, if the shoe fits, right? But I think the driving force behind NATO expansion is actually governments in Hungary.
I'm sorry to correct you. Some would say his charm. He did have,
yes,
he had a tendency. People liked him because the world disappears when you talk to him, apparently.
He is one of the great retail politicians. The drivers of a lot of NATO expansion are not to be found in the United States, right? It's actually the governments in Budapest, Hungary, Prague in the newly sort of separated Czech Republic, and right here where I'm speaking to you from in Warsaw, Poland, that were the first three to join and were passionate advocates for themselves. Why? Again, because they saw this as part of integrating into a much broader European political and cultural space. So take someone like Václav Havel, who's the president of the Czech Republic. He really chafed at the idea that Prague was sort of some eastern backwater. He would frequently point out, for example, that it is geographically further west than, for example, Vienna, Austria, which happens to be true, and that Prague had been in his sort of social milieu, Havel was a playwright, had been sort of cut off from their rightful European patrimony. And so in the United States, of course, it's critical that the Clinton administration is, to an even greater extent than the H.W. Bush administration before it, is very receptive to these overtures. But a lot of the push is coming from Eastern European states who want NATO membership because they want the opportunities of Europe. Meanwhile, though, I know I said that in the very late 80s, the story was really about these economic opportunities. Meanwhile, let's look at the Russian Federation, right? And there are basically two key factors, I think, that we need to think about here. The first is that it is political chaos, right? Both 1991 features a coup, 1993 features a sort of tanks in the streets, feels very much like onset of some kind of civil war. Politically, if you are even remotely in Russia's neighborhood, this needs to be grounds for concern, because what is going on in the Kremlin is deeply disquieting to European, Eastern European leaders who are envisioning a future away from Russia. The second critical element of this is that Russia is at this point fighting a brutal war in Chechnya, in the Northern Caucasus. So at the same time as Russian President Boris Yeltsin is saying to the Eastern Europeans, you know, why can't you count on us for your security? We helped provide your security for the last, you know, four or so decades. These Eastern European leaders are looking at the Russian brutal war in Chechnya and worrying that the combination of political instability that could install someone much less friendly to their aspirations, plus this capacity for brutality, would potentially spell disaster for not just their European project, but for them.
Let me ask you a question there. I think the other thing they were witnessing, and I welcome correction here, is they were witnessing the absorption of assets, rightfully those of the Russian people, by these various oligarchs and a corrupt system that had been corrupt, I'm sure, during the communist era, but was increasingly obviously corrupted through this process, some of which, you know, then relatively young Vladimir Putin, given his sort of various political roles at the time, was becoming more involved in.
Sure. No one would look at what was going on in Russia in the 1990s and say, you know what, that's the horse I want to hitch my wagon to, right? In terms of the onset of the massive kleptocracy, the large-scale war crimes in Chechnya, political instability, economic collapse. They have two basically catastrophic financial crises in one decade, 1992 and in 1998. Whereas if you looked at Western Europe and if you looked at unified Germany, that looked like a model. Certainly the way East Germany was integrated into West Germany was imperfect. But the way East Germany was integrated into West Germany was a wholesale takeover by West German institutions that did a lot, again, not everything right, to rapidly increase standard of living in that region.
Yeah, except decommissioning nuclear and then growing dependent on Russia's LNG, probably ill-considered in retrospect.
Yeah, that's a later policy that was really pushed by the Greens in much more recent years, which, yes, was completely misguided.
Completely misguided. But, you know, we've had these situations in history where people such as yourself, big thinkers on these topics, suddenly get access to a trove of documents. There were the Venona papers. You know, there are all these things that people can get access to who are researchers, but you've gotten access to the Warsaw Pact archives. So a couple questions on that. How did that happen and what are you finding?
So the how it happened is not a story about me and it's not a story about my kind of doggedness or ingenuity. In the 1990s, basically all of these countries passed various types of legislation mandating transparency on the history from the communist period. Oftentimes, the target in the earliest phases of this were the secret police. So in East Germany, it was the Stasi, the Ministry for State Security. In Poland, it was the SB. In Czechoslovakia, it was the STB, the Staatne Bezpieczeństwo, the secret police, whose archives were legally mandated to be opened up, because there was a sense among people that their basic rights of privacy had been wholesale violated by the state. and they were not wrong. East Germany, you know, had the most sort of comprehensive system of informants and surveillance that human society has ever cooked up. So those laws are really a gift for historians like me, because they enshrine a right to access to what were formerly amongst the most closely guarded secrets. In the early years, a lot of people use this to find out, you know, their personal histories, sometimes very tragically discovering that loved ones were informing on them in exchange for, you know, small favors from the secret police. Here I'm talking about, you know, children informing on parents, husbands informing on wives, and vice versa.
Gosh, that's like 1984. That's pretty sickening.
Oh, it's utterly Orwellian. The most bizarre that I ever came across personally in the Stasi archives was a kindergarten teacher informing on a child in her class, which of course then triggered investigations into the child's parents and his entire kind of community, because he said something pejorative about Leonid Brezhnev in 1982 when Brezhnev died. He said something like, "At last, the pig is dead." So this is now an extraordinary resource for someone like me, who wants to get into the official mind of these formerly very, very closed off states. And while I'm very interested in, you know, foreign intelligence and things like that, I'm not so much looking at those domestic repression questions right now in my work. But what I am finding is an absolute treasure trove of documents about war plans, including nuclear war, bargaining and haggling and negotiating between the ostensibly all-powerful Soviet Union and its much smaller, much weaker partners, like, for example, Romania, which under Nicolae Ceausescu, who was the dictator of Romania from the mid-1960s until he was executed in 1989, he was a brutal and also deeply weird dictator.
Deeply weird. You got to put some gloss on that here, Simon.
So Ceausescu admired, I think it's fair to say, the aesthetic of the North Korean regime, even if he didn't want to go as far. So I remember very fondly on a trip to Bucharest about, I guess it was about 2 years ago now, a tour of his palace, which included not just golden toilets, as is the, you know, all apparently the rage in the highest corridors of power in the United States, but entire golden bathrooms. And some of the most elaborate but gaudy mosaic work. His wife was elevated to the status of kind of basically smartest woman in Romania, despite not being probably the smartest woman in Romania. His son, Nico, was a drunk and almost certainly a serial rapist, and was allowed to kind of just maraud around Bucharest. It was a really horrific regime, but Ceausescu kind of imbued it with this very bizarre aesthetic sensibility.
And it ended kind of unceremoniously for Ceausescu. There was a moment where he came out to address the public and it was over.
Right. So one of Ceausescu's favorite things was giving speeches to enormous crowds of adoring fans. Entire factories would be detailed to send their workforce to watch and applaud and cry and do the appropriate thing at the
appropriate
time. The
whole dear leader shtick, right?
Yeah, exactly. This like very bizarre kind of Kim Dynasty style performance ritual. And eventually in 1989, Ceausescu staged one of these, I guess we could say. The people didn't play along. Now, at this point, there were already rumblings of trouble mostly in kind of the Transylvanian part of Romania. But in this time, you know, Ceausescu expected to be greeted by an audience of devoted admirers. And I think he did actually believe that these people all loved him. I think he was quite deluded in that sense, even though he certainly knew that he needed an extensive secret police apparatus to stop the people who loved him so much from killing him. The people didn't play their part. And he is booed and shouted at, and it rapidly dawns on him as the crowd becomes a mob that his time in office has come to an end. So he and his wife actually sort of helicopter out into the countryside to try to escape, try to hide for a while. They're found. He and his wife, Elena, are basically put on trial in some tiny rural schoolhouse. They are very expeditiously, i.e. in a matter of minutes, found guilty of, you know, treason and unspeakable crimes against the Romanian people, sentenced to death. And in a matter of just a few more minutes, they're basically just taken out back and shot. Romania is the only revolution of 1989 that turns really violent like that. And that is because of the uniquely kind of, for lack of a better term, depraved way in which Ceausescu ran his country with violence. He teed it up in a pretty profound way. He's the only leader who is killed. Many others will go to prison, for example, but Ceausescu is the only one who's killed.
But in, you know, lurking in the background of all of this was Vladimir Putin, who had been with what was then the KGB, ultimately became the FSB. He was a professional. He took his job, I think, pretty seriously, obviously had some sort of complex. But in looking at this archive material, it has to inform your view of what is happening right now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I wonder how it has.
Well, so let's take one example, and that's actually from Vladimir Putin's life. Vladimir Putin had a front row seat to the collapse of communism in East Germany. He is, you know, posted to Dresden, which is the third most important city in East Germany at the time. And he works out of a KGB facility that is kind of contained within a bigger Stasi East German secret police facility. And one night on the 9th of December, that facility was broken into actually by East Germans who wanted to see their files. They wanted to see the copious records that the state was keeping on them. They will succeed in getting into the Stasi repository there, even though as they do that, you know, Stasi officers are racing to burn or shred as much of the documentation that they've generated as possible before it's found. Eventually, the crowd turns on Putin, who is not alone, but I think is only sort of with a few clerical staff at this little sort of Russian sub-compound. And they start trying to break down those gates as well. And Putin tries to call for help, but he is basically told, "You're on your own, kid. You know, no help is coming." And this is still at a time when the Soviet Union has about 400,000 troops in East Germany. You know, it's not like they would have had to have put people on planes from Moscow to help out, right? They were just virtually, literally down the road. They had tank divisions. So Putin's told, "You're on your own, buddy." And as his people are basically trying to burn as much of their stuff as possible, he effectively kind of bluffs the crowd, sort of threatening that if they don't dissipate, they'll be shot by all the Russians with guns there. There are none. But I think this really has a profound impact on Putin in two ways. First, he writes about this. He says that he learned at that time that the Soviet Union had a terminal illness, and that was a paralysis of power. And I think in his governance of Russia, this is central to how he thinks, that Russian power is always something that you need to be ready to use, that you don't sort of just hold it in reserve, but rather that you use it to show that you have it and to show that you're willing to use it. And that it's only that that generates kind of the international respect and sort of heft that Russia deserves, that you have to demonstrate power in order to be given credit for having the power, basically. And the second thing I think that it learns is, look, he is living at this point in the late 1980s in the world's most sophisticated autocracy in terms of control and penetration of everyday life. No one, certainly not Hitler's Germany, not the Soviet Union, has ever come close to that level of sort of deep, sophisticated, autocratic control. And yet even that was brought down. And so I think that makes Putin keenly aware today of his own position. I think it's certainly no exaggeration to say that he does not think that there is a retirement for him, that the end of his presidency
been the history, has it?
Yeah, the end of his presidency is the end of his life. And he would rather not have that accelerated, but he knows just how close run a thing that could be.
Don't know that he really grasps how much he's setting that on course himself through his behavior right now. I do understand he has sort of this binary view of things. Let's flash forward. We find ourselves having to deal with him again, having to sort of consider the history of NATO, what it means to him. I'd like to talk to you about recent comments and discourse in the United States on NATO. So if I can just set the stage again, subject to your correction, many Democrats believe that we need a larger flow of economic support to Ukraine, as well as, you know, whatever we can provide in terms of weapons. Now, there is another view on the Republican side, and I don't mean to give it any longer attention, but the reason I'm focusing on our giving details is I think they're worth discussing. First, you had originally, as you may remember, Donald Trump complaining that NATO members were not paying a certain amount. Now, originally, you know, there was a lot of pushback, like it's not a purse that everybody's putting money into, but it's something else, right? It's what percentage of their GDP.
So 2% of GDP on defense spending has sort of become this threshold.
Okay. So not everybody was doing that, who was a member of NATO who aspired for membership in NATO, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's very true. There are a lot of countries, you know, Canada, for example, that are sitting more at like 1.5%.
But I would note a couple things. Recently, the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, has called for her country to start upping its spending on defense. I am hearing, we've heard of other European leaders saying this. Now, I'll tell you why I think this has come into sort of full relief of late. There is a congressman out there. His name is J.D. Vance. I'm not particularly a fan of him, but he has shown up at the Munich Security Conference. And I think in a sort of poking Europeans in the eyes kind of way, has written an op-ed piece in the Financial Times, which is widely read by European leaders. And it's entitled, Europe Must Stand on Its Own Two Feet on Defense. And I wondered, let's just kind of walk through some of the things that he said. He argues first that NATO members are creating a tax on American citizens in two ways. First, by not paying the amount of money that they should, or not spending the amount of money that they should on defense. But he makes a second point, and he said the NATO member nations have let their stockpiles of materiel disappear and are leaning on the United States to drain its critical stockpiles of materiel. Now, he adds in this that wars are won, rather, with men and materiel. And on this point, I think he's going to get some traction. He points out that the average age of a Ukrainian soldier is now 43, and that it really is only a matter of time before other countries will have to answer the call in support of Ukraine. And he says everything NATO members in Europe are doing right now suggests that they think that the United States will provide all three, men, money, and materiel. So I just wonder what you make of this argument and how this is being received in places like where you are right now, like Poland.
Well, I think we need to start, before we get into the senator from Ohio's comments, by acknowledging that the United States has always been very ambivalent about Europe standing on its own in terms of defense. And there have been many episodes throughout American foreign policy history in which Europe has started to look like it's going to stand on its own. And American leaders have said, wait, wait, pump the brakes. Maybe it would be a little bit better if you did less and let us take care of that. And there are various reasons why that has been American policy, including, you know, simply worrying that too powerful a European bloc wouldn't need America. And as such, the United States would be cast out, not, you know, literally unceremoniously, but would not have a place in Europe. So when Vance is saying, you know, you're doing these things, you need to stop it, a lot of what those European countries are doing has been what their American counterparts have wanted them to do, which is don't go too far in terms of military development. It is certainly the case, though, that Europe has real problems right now. It is not uniquely a European problem. It's also a problem in the United States that what we call the defense industrial base is hollowed out, that the assembly lines that produce a lot of the weapons of war that are being used right now in Ukraine, or their kind of analogs, are shut down. In many cases, they've been converted to make civilian products. And it is, you can't just start these things up like a light switch. That's a problem.
It's not like the movies, you know, where they turn the machine on and everybody floods back in and it just happens.
It's not.
Right?
It's not. We saw, for example, in the United States, right, the extraordinary performance of the Javelin anti-tank missile in the early months of the Ukraine war then gave way to kind of an American national panic about not having enough Javelins. The same was true also of Stinger, sort of man-portable anti-air missiles as well. And so this is a serious problem in Europe. It's a serious problem in the United States as well. And so when Vance says that this is a problem in Europe, he's not wrong. I agree with him on that point. It's also a problem in the United States. The issue, I think, becomes that it's not clear how abandoning the Europeans helps solve that problem.
Folks, thank you for listening. Share this podcast with a friend. When you do, have a conversation that involves listening to each other. Our strength is our unity and our ability to discuss hard things. We try to do that here in A Tone of Civility. We encourage you to do the same. Have comments for us. You can find us on social media platforms under the handle at ABA NatSec. You can always email us at natsec@americanbar.org. I just want to thank you for listening today. Your writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but I do this in my individual capacity always. Our editor is the lovely Francis Burkham of Brooklyn, and my co-producer. My other co-producer is the amazing Holly McMahon, who, by the way, can juggle plates and do five other things at the same time. She is something to behold. And the other producers of this podcast are always the members of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Law and National Security. These towering figures and brilliant minds are the very reason for this podcast, and we thank them. Without them, it would not be possible. We'll see you next week.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.